From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
The U.S. people must come to understand how this country, with 5% of the world population only, consumes 25% of the oil and energy of the world. I mean, that type of consumption is totally unbearable. And this planet cannot stand it anymore.
Today, our conversation with Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez continues. He reveals for the first time details of a plan to offer cheap oil to the poor of the United States. Then we take a look at oil and the environment with Ken Wiwa, the son of Ken Sarawiwa, executed in 1995 by the Nigerian military dictatorship, and Nobel Peace Prize winner Wangari Maathai.
We must manage our resources sustainably in order for us to be able to promote sustainable development and improve the quality of life of our people.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. New questions about Iraq's sovereignty are being raised after British forces attacked an Iraqi jail on Monday because they believed two detained British commandos were inside. British troops opened fire on the jail in Basra and used six armored vehicles to smash down the jail's walls as helicopter gunships flew overhead. The provincial governor of Basra described the British assault as, quote, barbaric, savage, and irresponsible. The Associated Press reported 150 prisoners escaped during the siege. As the British raided the prison, Iraqis started attacking the British vehicles with firebombs and rockets. One of the British armored fighting vehicles was set ablaze. Photos showed a British soldier on fire climbing out of the hatch and jumping to the ground as a crowd pelted him. An Iraqi official said the British soldiers were arrested after they'd fired at an Iraqi police officer. At the time, the British soldiers were undercover and dressed as Iraqis. After the prison was breached in Basra, the two soldiers were found not to be in the jail, but in a nearby house. The British Army attempted to downplay the incident, claiming the men were released after negotiations. The government said it feared for the lives of the British commandos after discovering they'd been handed to, quote, militia elements. The British attack on the Iraqi jail came one day after British forces arrested three members of the Shiite Mahdi Army. Also in Basra, an Iraqi reporter working for the New York Times was found shot dead Monday. The reporter, Fakhr Haider, had been handcuffed and taken away from his home Sunday night by four masked men. Last week, a 28-year-old Iraqi reporter for the newspaper Asafir was kidnapped in the northern city of Mosul. Police found her body the next morning with a single bullet wound to the head. In other news from Iraq, the Independent of London is reporting $1 billion has been stolen from the defense ministry. The Iraqi government is expected to issue an arrest warrant for Hazem al-Shallan, the former defense minister. Al-Shallan served under the U.S.-backed Ayatollahi. U.S. officials announced today a suicide car bomber had attacked a U.S. diplomatic convoy, killing four Americans. The military said a State Department agent died along with three employees of the North Carolina-based company Blackwater USA. Three State Department employees have now died in Iraq since June 2004. Fighting elsewhere in Iraq left at least 24 dead on Monday. A federal commission on voting is recommending all voters be required to show a driver's license or a state-issued ID card in order to vote by the year 2010. On Monday, the commission, headed by former President Jimmy Carter and former Secretary of State James Baker, issued a series of recommended reforms of the nation's voting system. Other suggestions include requiring paper verification of votes on electronic machines, for states rather than local jurisdictions supervise voter registration, and for the political parties to hold four regional presidential primaries following the Iowa caucuses and New Hampshire primaries. The photo ID provision is causing the most alarm. Spencer Overton, who served on the Carter-Baker Commission, said he dissented from the voter ID provisions. Overton said, quote, the commission's proposal is so excessive it would prevent eligible voters from proving their identity with even a valid U.S. passport or a U.S. military photo ID card. Two other commissioners oppose the measure, including former Senator Tom Daschle. Critics say it'll prevent many people from voting. According to the Washington Post, 12% of the voting age population does not have a driver's license, and those without identification tend disproportionately to be people of color, the elderly, and the poor. In New Orleans, the city's mayor, Ray Nagin, has suspended a plan to allow residents to begin returning home. The decision was made as another storm, Rita, is heading toward the Gulf Coast. The Times-Picayune reported state officials are preparing to move 13,000 Katrina evacuees from the southwest Louisiana coast to get out of the way from the storm. Portions of the Florida Keys have already been evacuated. In Mississippi, the state's attorney general, Jim Hood, has sued five private insurance companies, saying adjusters are trying to trick Hurricane Katrina survivors out of millions of dollars in homeowner claims. Insurance companies are offering property owners $3,000 in immediate living expenses if they sign a waiver that says all the damage to their property was caused by flooding, which is not covered in homeowners' policies. In Washington, the White House's top federal procurement officer was arrested Monday on charges of making false statements and obstructing a federal investigation into his dealings with lobbyist Jack Abramoff. Until last week, David Safavian was the head of procurement policy at the Office of Management and Budget. He's a former official with the General Services Administration. The Justice Department accuses him of aiding an unnamed Washington, D.C. lobbyist to acquire government-controlled property and that he took a golf trip to Scotland with the lobbyist. While Jack Abramoff is not mentioned by name, sources in Washington have said he's the unnamed lobbyist referenced in the criminal complaint. This marks the first criminal complaint filed against a government official in the ongoing corruption probe related to Abramoff's activities in Washington. In other news from Capitol Hill, at least 30 activists associated with the national disability rights group ADAPT were arrested Monday for refusing to leave House and Senate offices. They were protesting congressional plans to slow the growth of Medicaid spending by $10 billion over the next 5 years. On Sunday, about 100 protesters, most of them in wheelchairs, rallied outside Senate Majority Leader Dr. Bill Frist's Washington home. In business news, two former bosses of manufacturer Tyco were sentenced Monday to up to 25 years in prison for stealing more than $150 million. And in New York, police broke up a rally featuring Cindy Sheehan and arrested the rally's organizer. The police claim the protest organizers did not have a sound permit. Sheehan has been touring the country since ending her protest outside President Bush's estate in Crawford. She plans to be in Washington on Saturday for the national anti-war protest. And Simon Wiesenthal has died at the age of 96. After surviving the Holocaust, he spent decades tracking down Nazi war criminals. Through his work, some 1,100 Nazi war criminals were brought to justice. That's some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Today, we continue with our interview with Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez. He was in New York this last week for a summit of world leaders at the United Nations. In his speech, President Chavez blasted U.S. foreign policy and accused the Bush administration of trying to hijack the U.N. summit. He described the United States as a terrorist nation because it's harboring the televangelist Pat Robertson, who recently called for Chavez's assassination. President Chavez has long charged the U.S. was behind the aborted coup attempt against him in 2002. In our interview, Chavez reveals for the first time details of a plan to offer cheap oil to the poor here in the United States. Well, Democracy Now! Met with President Chavez on Friday in his first extended interview here in the country. I interviewed him with Democracy Now! Co-host Juan Gonzalez and Margaret Prescott of Pacifica radio station KPFK at the Venezuelan ambassador's home here in New York City. Welcome, Mr. President, to the United States. You have come to a country whose government, the U.S. government, you have accused of trying to assassinate you. What evidence do you have of this and of your other charge that it was involved with the attempted coup against you?
Thank you for the invitation to come to this show. Juan, Amy, and Margaret. And my greetings to all the people and the viewers and the listeners to these programs, these well-known programs. Let's talk about life rather than death, because we are fighting for life. However, there are always threats. Those who are devoted to the struggle for life and use the truth as a flag and our principles as a lifeline. There is no doubt whatsoever that the U.S. government, led by Mr. Bush, planned and participated in a coup d'etat in Venezuela in April 2002. There are many proofs and evidence of this. There is a U.S. lady who wrote a book called The Chavez Code. Mrs. Eva Gollinger, and she was sitting here not too long ago, and she is very close, and there are declassified documents that she has found thanks to an effort to investigate the situation. I have many evidences that my assassination was ordered on April the 11th. More precisely, on April the 12th, and I was ready to die. However, thank God, and thanks to the Venezuelan people, and thanks to the soldiers, Venezuelan soldiers, this order was not accomplished, and this order was given by Washington. And there are many evidences and witnesses. However, I would like to talk about life and greet the U.S. people with a lot of affection, with a lot of love, and with a lot of pain due to the tragedy in New Orleans and the Gulf states. We've been accompanying these states from the very beginning, and we've been watching TV and receiving reports by our ambassadors and the CITGO people from the very beginning, cooperating very humbly, trying to save lives and assist the homeless. We have offered assistance up to $5 million, a very modest sum, but I guess it would be useful. We have offered medicine, water, and electric power plants, the same way Cuba offered doctors. So far, we have not been authorized to reach the area. However, we hope the best for the poor, the poorest of these countries.
And televangelist Pat Robertson, his call for your assassination, what do you demand now, and what is your response to that?
Robertson, no es Robertson.
Well, as a matter of fact, Robertson is not acting alone. He's just conveying, in a perhaps desperate manner, the thinking of those people closer to Mr. Bush. This is the voice of the most radical of the extreme right wing in the U.S. I am totally convinced that is the situation with Mr. Robertson. And as you can see so far, there has been no reaction by the U.S. government in this regard. There's nothing being said about these terrorist remarks that is in full breach of international law and breaches the laws of the United States. But it's not only Mr. Robertson here. For some time, for some months, people who participated in a coup attempt in Venezuela and are living here in the United States. And from TV stations in this country, these people are calling for my assassination. A week ago, in another TV show, people in uniform, in fatigues, like terrorists, Venezuelans and Americans and Cubans, exiled in the United States, and a former agent of the CIA, very recently said on TV that Chavez should be dead already. That Robertson is right. So this is the desire and the voice of the ultra-conservative right-wing elite of the United States. They threaten Chavez. Chavez is nothing. Who is me? I am nothing. They are threatening the world. This is serious. They invaded Iraq without any reason whatsoever. They violated international law and are ignoring the rules of the UN. Terrorists bombard complete cities, such as Fallujah, Baghdad, innocent women and children. Now, history is long. Hiroshima, for instance, Nagasaki, Grenada, Haiti, Panama, Santo Domingo. No, that is not. They do not represent the people of the United States. They are part of the imperialist dictatorship that the U.S. people are suffering today.
Mr. President, on behalf of KPFK, Pacifica Radio in Southern California, welcome to the United States. We have been waiting for this moment. Many people in the United States have been shocked at the racism they have witnessed against low-income people in New Orleans and the other Gulf cities. And we wonder, how do Venezuelans view what has happened? And also, you are clearly working to unite people of color throughout the world. You are the first Latin American president we know of who identifies as black and indigenous, and this breaks a long tradition of racism in the Americas. You've also identified with the people of Haiti who are fighting to defeat a brutal coup against their president. How crucial do you think the defeat of all racism is to making the fundamental economic and social changes needed to save the world from the destruction of the market?
When we were children, we were told that we have a motherland, and that motherland was Spain. However, we have discovered later in our lives that, as a matter of fact, we have several motherlands, and one of the greatest motherlands of all is no doubt Africa. We love Africa. And every day, we are much more aware of the roots we have in Africa. Also, America is our motherland. Africa, America, and Bolivar used to say that we are a new human race in Latin America. That we are not Europeans, nor Africans, or North Americans. That we are a mixture of all those races. And there is no doubt that Africa resounds with a pulse like 1,000 drums, and happiness and joy. But also there's a lot of pain when you think of Africa. Yesterday, I met with the president of Mozambique because, fully aware of these roots and these realities, we have designed an agenda for Africa in Venezuela. And we have spoken to other South American leaders. Lula, for instance, is fully aware of the African roots of Brazil and South America. And I want to share the African agenda with other leaders in South America. But Venezuela has also its own African agenda. In the case of Mozambique, the life expectancy in Mozambique is 38 years old and going down because AIDS is causing havoc in the population. It's terrible. It's a tragedy. It's a million Katrinas hitting this country. The president of Mozambique told me the number of children, orphaned children, whose parents have died as a result of AIDS. The teachers are dying. The doctors are dying. That's a tragedy. And it's a disgrace. And that's why it hurts. It hurts so much to see the UN opening its doors, to listen to speeches and more speeches while at the same time, every year, a population equivalent to Argentina today, or Colombia, die of hunger, or Venezuela die of hunger. And those deaths could be avoided. Most of them are children, little girls, little boys, and most of them are in Africa. So, we need like a shaking of the world, to shake up the world. That's why when people talk about my style, that's why the speech I delivered yesterday before the United Nations Assembly, because it doesn't work. It's not working. If we reduced the military expenses in 10% of the world, we would have enough money to save millions of lives in this world. In Venezuela, with the little resources, few resources, we have initiated a program to bring food to feed the poor people in Venezuela. And we are covering today 15 million people in Venezuela receiving this food distribution and assistance. And most of them receive this food for free, and others a percentage. They have to pay only 50% of the total amount for the food they eat. And of course, this is possible only if the people themselves participate and with a new awareness. Racism is very characteristic of imperialism. Racism is very characteristic of capitalism. Katrina is indeed has a lot to do with racism, no doubt about it. Hate against me has a lot to do with racism. Because of my big mouth, because of my curly hair. And I'm so proud to have this mouth and this hair because it's African. So we need a new morality, a new ethic at this point. And from my Christian point of view, we need a revolution of the ethic. And in the political and economic fields, we need to take back the flag of socialism, in my view, in order to be able to defeat with the will of the people, with the participation of the people, to beat those ominous phenomena such as racism.
Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez in his first interview in the United States. When we come back, he talks about his offer of cheap oil to the poor here in the United States. And then we'll speak with Nobel Peace Prize winner Wangari Maathai and the son of executed Nigerian environmentalist Ken Sarawiwa. His name is Ken Wiwa. Stay with us. Music by Orchestra Baobab here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we return to our conversation with Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez, the first he had here in the United States, Democracy Now! Interviewed President Chavez on Friday. We met with him in the Venezuelan ambassador's home here in New York. We talked with him my co-host Juan Gonzalez and Margaret Prescott of KPFK.
Mr. President, welcome. Bienvenido a los Estados Unidos.
Gracias.
Your democratic revolution has a different aspect to it. Su revolución democrática tiene un aspecto distinto in that you're rich in oil and the world badly needs oil. We've heard what you're doing in Latin America to use oil as a weapon to assist the poor. Could you tell us a little more about what you are offering the communities of the United States who are also suffering from high oil prices?
Sí, fíjate que eso surge de nuestra conciencia.
This is the result of our awareness
de que solo integrándonos los pueblos más necesitados podremos salir adelante.
That only through integration we can advance and we can progress among Latin American countries, breaking the paradigm of capitalism, of free trade, and neoliberalism. In the year 2000, we started a cooperation program, especially with the Caribbean and Central American countries, and some of the South American countries, with the Caracas Energy Accord. And there, for the first time in history, we included Cuba. Because Cuba is considered like a country that is not part of the Americas, and we think it is part of the Americas. Jamaica, Nicaragua, Grenada, many countries. This mechanism includes the sale of oil and oil byproducts with a discount of up to 25%. This discount becomes, in the end, a donation we give these countries. However, when the price of oil starts increases, in the year 2000 we signed the Caracas Accord, and the price at that time was $20-$25 a barrel. When we realized that the prices started to increase, and it goes beyond 40 and beyond 50, and I doubt very much the price is going to drop anytime soon, because this is part of the structural crisis. The world has to face it. It is a reality. There is a drop in the oil reserves. There is an increase in consumption and demand. The refining capacity is low. The consumerism of the world is unbearable. The world of the U.S. people must come to understand how this country, with 5% of the world population only, consumes 25% of the oil and energy of the world. I mean, that type of consumption is totally unbearable, and this planet cannot stand it anymore. When we realized that the price of oil went up beyond $50, we initiated another cooperation scheme. We have created, therefore, Petrocaribe, and we are going to start with small Caribbean and CARICOM countries and the larger Antilles, such as Cuba, Jamaica, and Dominican Republic. So we're now providing, first, we're ensuring the supply of oil, direct supply of oil from state to state, in order to avoid the speculation of multinationals and traders. They buy gasoline in Venezuela, and then they go to a Caribbean country and they charge double. So we are selling the products to the states directly. We are not charging for freight. We assume the cost of freight. But apart from that, this discount is not of 25%, it goes to 40% of the total. And this money will be paid back in 25 years' time, with 2 years of grace and 1% interest rates. So if you make all of the mathematical calculations, the donation percentage is almost 70%, because it's a long-term adjusted 1%. So what Venezuela is doing is supplying 200,000 barrels of oil to the Caribbean and other Central American and South American countries, such as Paraguay, Uruguay, and smaller nations in South America.
Cerca de 200 mil millones de barriles, te dije.
200,000, millions of barrels. If you apply calculations, mathematical calculations, by 1.5% of our GDP, 1.5% of the GDP is devoted to this cooperation. It means that we are financing these sister nations that next year will reach $1.7 billion a year. In 10 years, it's $17 billion. It's a way for us to share our resources with these countries. And what about the U.S. population? Well, after many meetings with the U.S. citizens, we decided to propose a scheme for poor populations and low-income populations in the U.S. We've seen that poverty in the U.S. is growing everywhere. It's close to 11% poverty, according to some estimates. And instead of the figures, you have to go deeper into it. Because if you see Katrina and you saw what's happened, 100,000 people were abandoned, and they are abandoned, and they're just surviving. So here we have Citgo, this oil company. We have the Citgo company here in the United States. This is a Venezuelan company. So let's have a look at the U.S. map, the distribution area of Citgo in the U.S. We are present in 14,000 gas stations in the U.S. And here we have different refineries, asphalt refineries, 8 refineries that we have in the U.S. The plants for filling units, the third refineries, terminals, and so on. We want to use these infrastructures to help the poor populations. We have made some progress. We have given instructions to the president of Citgo, Felix Rodriguez. We want that up to 10% we refine here. We supply every day to the U.S. 1.5 million barrels of oil, crude and product. And we refine here close to 800,000 barrels a day, refined here in the U.S. So we would like to take 10% of what we refine, those products, and to offer these products in several modalities to the poor populations. And the pilot project will be starting in Chicago. We are already operating in Chicago. Well, let's hope that there's not going to be any obstacle by the government opposed to this project being implemented, but we will be working in those poor populations. We have some allies, local partners, and we have a number of communities, and we are going to donate some heating oil because the winter is close, and for the school transportation to school, for the Mexican neighborhood, which is the largest in Chicago. La Villita is the name of this neighborhood with close to 900,000 inhabitants. And so there are other neighborhoods with Hispanics and Latinos. October the 14th, we're going to start with these pilot projects with small communities and schools. But there are other pilot projects that will start in November in Boston and here in New York. So different modalities with local authorities, mayors, organized communities, religious groups. So we are very pleased to announce this and to help just with a drop and a grain of contribution to help these low-income populations, blacks or Hispanics, or also white population. So we're just starting with this project.
Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez speaking in his first interview in the United States. Again, during that interview, President Chavez making an offer to supply cheap oil to the poor, America's poor. Oil and the environment is what we'll speak about next. And if you'd like to get a copy of the transcript of the full interview with President Chavez, you can go to our website at democracynow.org. Yesterday and today, the two halves of that interview. You can also, we are also podcasting, and you can get it at video and audio streaming at democracynow.org. But now, oil and the environment. Yes, oil and the environment and other environmental issues is what we're going to talk about today with perhaps the leading environmentalist in the world, Wangari Maathai, the 2004 Nobel Peace Prize winner. We are also joined by Ken Wiwa, who is the son of Ken Sarawiwa, the Nigerian environmentalist who was executed in 1995 by the Nigerian military dictatorship. Ken Sarawiwa led the movement against Shell Corporation's exploitation of his homeland, Ogoni Land. In 1994, Ken Sarawiwa was imprisoned, and he was tried by what many called a kangaroo court, and ultimately on November 10th, 1995, despite widespread international outcry, was executed. Welcome both to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
It's good to have you both with us.
Thank you.
Well, we're going to begin with Wangari Maathai. You've come back to New York at the same time that the UN summit has taken place, scores of world leaders coming to New York. You were here for what?
Well, I'm here partly to continue sharing the message that was given to us by the Norwegian Nobel Committee that decided that environment, democracy, or good governance, and peace are very closely linked, and to continue exploring this linkage and challenging all of us to think clearly along those lines, and also to attend the Clinton Global Initiative that was taking place here in New York. And there were also some other activities that I will be attending, but they are all to do with my laureate year and the challenge to continue sharing this message.
There's been a lot of criticism of the UN document that has just come out. A lot of charges that the U.S. intervened to water down its goals and commitments. What is your take on that?
I think that there is hardly any time that I have listened to the UN and have come out with the document that the world felt that they were strong documents. There is always a feeling that when the leaders of the world come together, they don't always commit themselves as strongly as we would like them to. But I have always felt that the challenge really lies at the national level, that many of the heads of states who were here in New York have to demonstrate their commitment to these goals at the national level. Allocate adequate resources to these national goals, ask their own people to be committed and to try to implement these goals, and not to expect that by coming to the UN and passing strong documents, the goals will be realized. So I want to say, yes, the document was watered down, but yes, it is the leaders themselves who must make sure that these goals are realized at the national level.
What do you think is the most critical issue to take on right now at a global level and also in your own country of Kenya?
Well, looking at all those goals, I really feel that while all the goals are very, very important, the one goal that I think is a very important goal is goal number 7, the goal on sustainable management of our resources. And this is because if you manage the resources responsibly, accountably, if you try to share those resources equitably at the national level, a lot of those goals will be realized, or it will be much easier to realize those goals. But no matter what we do, if we do not manage our environment sustainably, those goals will not be realized. So I really think that the goal number 7 is extremely important, coupled with a deliberate and an honest commitment by governments to promote justice and equity at the national level.
Wangari Maathai is the 2004 Nobel Peace Prize winner. We'll be back with her, as well as the son of Ken Sarawiwa. Ken Wiwa, stay with us. Fela here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We're broadcasting on over 375 stations around the country on Pacifica, NPR, and low-power FM radio stations, as well as on public access TV and PBS stations. We also are broadcasting on both TV satellite networks, Dish Network, Channel 9415, Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, as well as on DirecTV, Channel 375, and podcasting at our website, democracynow.org. Our headlines are also in Spanish there, both transcript and audio. I'm Amy Goodman as we continue with our guests, Wangari Maathai, the 2004 Nobel Peace Prize winner, and Ken Wiwa, the son of Ken Sarawiwa. I will never forget meeting Ken Sarawiwa in 1994 when he came to our studios at Pacifica Station, WBAI, here in New York. He hadn't been scheduled for an interview on our local morning show, Wake Up Call, which I hosted with Bernard White of WBAI, but an activist brought him in, said he was just there for the morning and would like to come on the show. I'm ashamed to say we hadn't even heard of him at that point. But since they said he was only available that morning, we began the interview, said we could only do a few minutes, and then minute by minute, we shed the next guest throughout the show so that we only ended up interviewing Ken Sarawiwa as he talked about the nexus of corporate government and military power in his home of Nigeria, Africa's most populous country, particularly in Ogoni land, and talked about his struggle against Shell Corporation. This is a brief excerpt of what Ken Sarawiwa had to say.
Shell, they had a meeting, operatives of Shell in Nigeria and of those at The Hague in the Netherlands and in London held a meeting, and they decided that they would have to keep an eye on me and watch wherever I go to, follow me constantly to ensure that I do not embarrass Shell. So as far as I'm concerned, I'm a marked man where Shell are concerned, and indeed I have been in detention in Nigeria several times. My passport has been impounded. The last time round, in the middle of June, I was held for 31 days without charge. And eventually...
The Nigerian government held
me. The Nigerian government held me, shunted me from prison to prison. And it's only international concern that allowed them to send me on bail. Early this year, on the 2nd of January, to be precise, I was placed under house arrest with my entire family for 3 days in order to stop a planned protest against Shell. 300,000 Ogoni people were going to move to protest the devastation of the environment by Shell and the other multinational oil companies. And it was in the interest of these companies to ensure that I was not, that this demonstration did not hold. And all they did was simply send the military authorities to my house. They disconnected my telephones, confiscated the handsets. And I was held for 3 days without food.
Ken Sarawiwa speaking in 1994. This is Democracy Now! Ken Wiwa, his son, is our guest. Ken Sarawiwa was ultimately executed when he went back to Nigeria. As he said, I am a marked man. And he was arrested in May of 94, executed November 10th, 1995. Ken Wiwa, welcome as well.
Good morning, Amy.
It's good to have you with us. You are here talking about your father. You wrote a book about him as well, In the Shadow of a Saint, about your father. Can you talk about his struggle with Shell Corporation, with the Nigerian military?
Yeah, I mean, my father began as a 17-year-old writing letters, protest letters in local papers, protesting about the role of oil companies in our community. And for 30 years, it really informed his writing and his political activism. And he was a consistent campaigner against the effects of oil pollution, the effect of oil on the political culture of my country. And eventually he became so effective, mobilizing the community to stand up for their rights, to protest for their rights, drawing international attention to what was happening in my country. He became so effective that they decided to do away with him.
Where were you at the time he was arrested?
I was in England. I'd been brought up partly in England, and I was born and raised in Nigeria and also raised in England.
What was the role of Shell at that time, once he was arrested, held, and then ultimately executed? How powerful was it? Do you believe it could have stopped the execution?
Well, Brian Anderson, the chairman of Shell Nigeria, met my uncle.
Owens
Wiwa. He offered to do something if we stopped the international protests. So Shell were more concerned about their image, about the damage that our protests was doing to their image, than they were concerned about the material issues in which my father had raised about the effects of their activities in my community. They also held a watching brief, legal brief, at the trial that sentenced my father to death. And two prosecution witnesses testified, sworn affidavits that they had been offered bribes, Shell contracts, to testify against my father. They were actively involved in the conspiracy to silence my father.
Have you spoken to them since?
Well, you know, we make representations to them. You know, my father didn't bear grudges. It's not in our nature of my family or my community to bear grudges. We believe that, you know, Shell were part of the problem. They must be part of the solution. We still feel that with some kind of dignity and a commitment to social justice, that the situation could still be salvaged. But, you know, it's been 10 years, almost 10 years, since my father was executed. And it's only this year that we managed to retrieve his bones, and we're going to give him a proper burial. Not one single member of the Nigerian military, which invaded Ogoni, conducted extrajudicial murders, raped young girls, women, all in the name of trying to suppress the protests of our organization so that oil could resume. Not one member of the military has been arrested or tried or detained, or held accountable for what happened in Ogoni. So, you know, I think, you know, as I say, justice denied, delayed is justice denied. And unfortunately, what's happening in Nigeria as a whole is that the non-violent methods, which my father advocated, is being replaced by a more violent approach or a radical approach. As they say, if you make non-violent change impossible, you make violent change inevitable.
Mm-hmm. And what are the roles of Shell Corporation, also Chevron and others right now in the Niger Delta in Nigeria?
The oil companies are very, they're instrumental. I mean, 90% of the foreign exchange revenues and 80% of government revenues come from oil in Nigeria. What's allegedly what's good for the oil companies in Nigeria is good for the Nigerian people. But that's not the case. We know that's not the case. But, you know, what worries me is that 25% of U.S. oil is going to come from the Gulf, from that area, from West Africa in the next 10 years. Nigeria is going to set to increase production from 2.2 million barrels a day to 4.4 million barrels a day. So Nigeria is going to be increasingly important in the energy security triangle, if you like. And the oil companies continue to pump oil, continue to drill for oil, continue business as usual. But unfortunately, I think they have to now start paying attention to the social, cultural, and environmental effects of that business as usual. Because it can't continue. It's not sustainable.
When I went to Nigeria in 1998 with my colleague, Democracy Now! Correspondent Jeremy Scahill, doing a documentary on Chevron and its involvement in the Niger Delta, we visited your grandparents, who've since both died, at their compound as they remembered Ken, and the whole community came out, hundreds of people. One man actually recited the speech that your father gave in court.
He was prevented from making that. It would have been
his
final.
But he wrote it?
Yes. It would have been his final statement to the tribunal. But it's a powerful statement. And in it, I remember very clearly, he does say that the signs that this court is giving out will be picked up by the waiting public, whether the nonviolent means he advocated or the violence which has been visited on our people will be clearly sent to the people.
We'll link to it on our website, democracynow.org, and maybe by the end of the show we can get it. It's in the documentary Drilling and Killing, Chevron and Nigeria's Oil Dictatorship. But Wangari Maathai, did you ever meet Ken Saro-Wiwa, and how did his work influence yours?
Unfortunately, we never met. But I knew of his work, and I'm sure he knew of our work in East Africa. We knew that what he was really doing was raising a challenge to a corporation in a culture that has been very typical in the entire continent. We know that most people in the world look at Africa as a poor continent, because most people in Africa are always presented as being poor. But, excuse me, people like Ken Saro-Wiwa were bringing out the facts clearly to demonstrate that Africa is not poor. Africa is extremely rich, but her resources are exploited and her people do not benefit from those resources. And the case of the Ugandan land and the Ugandan people was very clear demonstration of how resources can be exploited and the people do not benefit.
Do you see the occupation of Iraq, the war in Iraq, as a war over resources?
Well, I don't want to make that statement categorically. What I would make is a general statement that most conflicts in this world are due to resources, are due to the fact that there are those of us who feel like we have a right to access resources wherever they are. We have a right to exploit those resources wherever they are. And we do not feel obligated to share those resources equitably. We want to exclude. Now, unfortunately, in many places, those who feel excluded become frustrated, angry, and sometimes will undermine our peace and security. And therefore, it's not surprising that whether it is in Nigeria, in Kenya, in Darfur, in Congo, to mention a few examples in my own continent, whenever you have injustices, inequalities, exclusion of the opportunity to share these resources, you will have conflict. And it is, in a way, self-deceptive to believe that we can create peace by subduing, by excluding. We can't. Sooner or later, those who are excluded become angry and they react.
Ken Wiwo, what do you think has to happen now with oil really very much on the minds of everyone in this country, from the issue of Hurricane Katrina to Iraq?
Well, I think we have to be more vigilant as citizens. We have to understand the connections between the oil industry and government. We have to make governments more accountable to the people and the planet, not just accountable to those to big oil. Here in the U.S., since this administration came to power, the top five oil companies have made $250 billion, and they gave campaign contributions of $50 million. So we have to be aware of the effect of oil on the political system. Now, I'm working with, I'm on this tour with an organization called Oil Change, which is trying to separate oil from state. And you can look them up on thepriceofoil.com. But apart from that, too, I think we're building democracy deficits in the West, because where these companies get the power to influence political public policy in the U.S. is in places like Nigeria, where they're not accountable. What we're trying to do down there is to emphasize the nonviolent solutions. And the Ken Saro-Wiwa Foundation, which we've launched this year, is trying to uphold the legacy of nonviolence that my father began, that we must absolutely work for a sustainable future on a nonviolent platform. Otherwise, what's happening now is that the region is being militarized as there's a rush for oil. There's a new Cold War over Africa between the US and China, and they're trying to grab the resources of Africa. You know, two-thirds of the world's resources, natural resources, are in Africa. And unfortunately, this rush, this grab for oil, is militarizing the zone.
Would you say the situation is worse than it was 10 years ago when your father was executed?
I think so, because there's there's an infiltration of small arms now in West Africa. In the Niger Delta, where I'm living, there are four small
You're
arms.
In Port Harcourt.
There's four small arms to every computer. The 70% of Africans are under the age of 25, and young people now see, they're not getting the opportunities that these resources, if they were applied to the development of their potential. They're not seeing the benefits from these resources, and I'm afraid of what's going to happen if we continue to apply military solutions to what should be, what we're quite clearly capable of developing, the human potential and building the infrastructure to give those people a chance.
I want to thank you both for being with us. Ken Wiwa and Wangari Maathai. Ken Wiwa will be speaking tonight in New York at St. Illuminators Hall at 221 East 27th Street. Wangari Maathai, Nobel Peace Prize winner 2004, speaking at Harvard University in Massachusetts on Friday, September 30th. That does it for our show. We will post the speech of Hugo Chavez on our website at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Berkshire, Fabio Caduce, John Hamilton, on Nagara Elizabeth Press, Ruba Rich, and Jeremy Scahill. Very special thanks to Isis Phillips and Karen Renucci. And John Hamilton, I'm Amy Goodman.